Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey everybody, I've got a little bit of housekeeping here before we get into the episode about Instagram and Theology Beer Camp. So I've been getting more active on Instagram, and I just want to let you guys know, in case you want to see me make some videos where I look directly into the camera, I'm sharing some stories and posts about basically all the topics that we cover on this show over at Instagram.com/DanKoke. That's C-O-K-E, and the link is in the show notes. Also, Theology Beer Camp is returning in 2024, October 17th through 19th. The theme is Return of the God Pods. That is a Lord of the Rings reference, which should surprise nobody. I will be there alongside Brian McLaren, Diana Butler-Bass, The New Evangelicals, Bible for Normal People, Tony and Josh from GGCH, of course, Trip Fuller and Homebrewed Christianity, and a whole grip of others. And you can use the promo code RETURNOFYHP, all one word, for $25 off your ticket. Prices go up starting June 1st. That link will be in the notes. I hope to see a bunch of you guys there in October. It was a serious highlight of last year for me.
If you're listening to this podcast, you must recognize the value of asking questions. At Aramco, our questions help us engineer a better future. How can today's resources fuel our shared tomorrow? How can we deliver energy to a world that can't stop? How can we deliver one of the fuels of the future? How can we sow curiosity to harvest ingenuity? To learn more about how innovation drives us forward, visit aramco.com/poweredbyhow.
Shop Amazon for last-minute gifts. Great deals for everyone on your list. Gifts for mom and gifts for dad. Even for your sister and your brother, Chad. Ah, shoot, we didn't realize we were supposed to get a gift for our dog walker guy. We almost forgot about our dentist, Dr. Kerr. We didn't expect to get a gift from her. Or our cousin, I forget his name. He got us something nice, better reciprocate. For last-minute deals on gifts for people you forgot, get fast and free shipping at Amazon.
My name is Dan Koch. Like many of you, I've been on a complicated faith journey for a number of years now. And while I tend to find myself on the progressive side of Christianity, my goal is not to make liberal converts. I want this show to be a resource for Christians to my right and to my left, as well as former Christians and non-religious folks, anyone who finds themselves asking difficult questions about God, science, prayer, fate, suffering, evangelism, and more. So many of us have been given bad answers to those good questions, often by people with pure intentions. I want to say that you have permission to take both Christianity and the modern world very seriously. And I hope to facilitate that by introducing you to people seeking God across the Christian spectrum, engaging hard questions in a multitude of ways. Thanks for listening. I am so stoked to be joined by Caitlin Beatty and Roxy Stone, also known as Roxanne Stone in her professional capacity. These wonderful women co-host the Saved by the City podcast, which is put out by Religion News Service. I highly recommend that podcast. And in fact, you guys did a very tight, efficient 20-some minute episode about the Christianity Today article. And I'm going to put that at the top of the show notes because I think that we'll cover some of the same ground, but I would recommend people listen to that. It's fairly short. You guys get into so many good sort of juicy angles of how to think about this in a very efficient manner that has me frankly jealous. it is appropriate that my podcast, which takes place in the wooded suburbs of Seattle, is generally a luxurious 90-minute conversation, and that your Manhattan, New York City podcast is like 30 to 45. I think it's sensible, right?
I like that. I like that context and framing. Yeah, we got to get things. We got to go fast around here.
We're going to compromise today at about an hour, maybe a little under. And Roxy, you're actually a big mucky muck about town and have to leave us halfway through be on NPR, all things considered. So we're very happy for you.
Thank you. Yeah, that'll be fun too. But I'm excited to be here right now.
Well, thank you. And I will attempt to believe you. But if I were you, I would be distracted. So we are talking more about the scandals that we talked about 2 weeks ago. So this is Bruxy Cavey and Meeting House in Canada, the Christianity Today sexual harassment workplace, big article that dropped, and the recent Hillsong stuff. And since then, Brian Houston, the founder, has officially stepped down. We can also get into, I think, Carl Lentz, which that's about a year old story, but it's really directly connected to the Brian Houston stuff and really everything that we're talking about today. Mm-hmm. Caitlin and Roxy, thank you guys so much for joining me today. We got through our conversation last week. We did not have any women on that episode. I sort of took a patron thing we were going to do with our friend Josh and Tony and said, let's move it up because of this breaking news about Christianity Today and Hillsong. And we didn't have any women on there. We missed a lot of angles. Many people that I respect, including my wife and a number of my closest friends, said, good episode, but there's more to discuss, and they're completely right. And I feel honored to be able to discuss it with the two of you.
So we just need to represent like half of the human population.
Exactly. So your episode. Job,
no pressure.
Your mission, but not only am I excited that you are women, because half people that I could theoretically interview are women, but you guys both worked at Christianity Today, so you have boots on the ground experience. Roxy, you were there for 1 year during the sort of two decade long-ish period that the article is talking about. Caitlin, you were there for almost a decade of that time, and you rose all the way up to managing editor before you left Christianity Today, right before the Trump moment, by the way. One of my personal favorite all-time leaving evangelical institution timings is yours. And you told that story on the Depolarize interview that we did many years ago. So all that is to say, you guys have, not only your own perspective as brilliant women, but personal experience in at least one of these three big scandals. So lots to talk about. I'm going to try and not go over too much of what you guys went over in your episode because it was so good and I want people to listen to that. But let's start with one of the things that you guys brought up that I think is really interesting because it's come up before on here and on Depolarize, which is the Billy Graham Mike Pence rule. And that has an interesting intersection with what went on at Christianity Today. What do you guys want to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I tell this story on our episode of the podcast last week, and Caitlin may have more to talk about when it comes to this, but I know for me, when I was working at Christianity Today, which was not for a long time, but it was the first time I encountered that rule. And, it was with a coworker who I was this person's direct boss. So I had to go on like a trip with them. And that's when he brought up that, he couldn't do that.
And this is such a good anecdote. It's such a good one. Oh
and
my
ended
gosh.
Up, I mean, ended up inviting his wife along, which is a completely normal thing to do. And spouses go on work trips all the time, but probably could have happened without the pronouncements and the drama, which as I mentioned on our show, like kind of interjected a sexual tension into a relationship that really didn't have it up until that point and made like just a completely normal work situation into this bizarre, like walking on eggshell situation where I was like, oh, did I do something wrong? Does he think something about me? Like what is this, and part of what also contributes to, I think, the broader conversation here, not just like a specific scenario or instance, is the ways that the Billy Graham rule in a modern workplace where men and women are working together and supervising each other and traveling together is that it creates these artificial boundaries and barriers between the two sexes in a way that just hinders business and also hinders the ability for women in particular to make inroads into environments where the leadership is dominated by men.
Right.
Yeah, just a little bit of historical background. So this rule came out of a meeting that the evangelist Billy Graham had with some of his closest male colleagues just when their crusades were really taking off in the 40s and 50s. And they made a series of agreements together to kind of maintain personal integrity. And one of them is that none of them would meet alone with women. Of course, this was a time when men and women weren't interacting nearly as much in the workplace. Like, it was totally easy for Billy Graham and his colleagues to make this rule because, to my knowledge, there weren't any women on their staff.
Right.
But part of the question about its usefulness comes especially in Christian organizations where most of the leadership are men to begin with. Does this become a hindrance for women to be mentored? Like, it's not unreasonable to think that if a senior staff member who's a man has like a male mentor and a female mentor that are both like rising up through the ranks, but he has this personal rule that I'm only going to meet with men alone. Well, of course, the female staff member is going to be left out and is going to be left behind. One of the weirdest interpretations of this rule that I heard was in a meeting with an organization that I formerly served on the board of. They were trying to decide whether to keep this rule. And one of the men in the meeting said, well, look, like, it's really worked for us. And whenever a man and a woman are traveling like overseas, because this was an international organization, the man drives and they need to get someplace. The man drives the car and the woman just sits in the back.
Oh, my gosh.
And like everybody, and it's totally fine. And like, it's just what people do. And I'm like, that's so weird.
It's hard to have physical contact from front seat to back seat, Caitlin.
Yeah, it's almost this, like, as you said, Roxy, it injects sexual tension.
Yes.
Into a situation. It's almost as if to imply if we were both sitting in the front, we would be grabbing each other.
Of course.
And so the way that we avoid this is to have the woman sit in the back.
Also, couldn't the woman drive and the man sit in the back? I mean, come on.
Also, women can't drive, but that's for another episode.
It's almost like an SNL sketch. And if they did it as a sketch, it would be, and while you're back there, make sure to be a backseat driver and nag the man as much as possible so that he's not sexually attracted to you. Like, you could lean into the gender stereotypes and make a pretty good bit out of it.
Sure.
That is so silly. But Roxy,
you were
talking about sort of access to networks and places. And in the Christianity Today article, they mentioned golfing and that these men at the top of the organization who are responsible, you know, for both the harassment behavior, but also people like Richard Shields, the head of HR, directly responsible for this decades long, basically, like, we're just not going to document any of this old boys club sort of, we'll deal with this internally, air quotes, kind of a thing. They all went golfing together and women weren't on those golf trips, which means women aren't in the geographical space having the conversations with the people who run the organization.
It's interesting because anytime I've talked about the Billy Graham rule in the past, like, I've done a few different conferences and speaking on it, I always bring up golf as one of these sort of the quintessential space that men like form bonds and often network outside of the workplace. And it's not just the golf, you know, it was a very eye roll moment for me in the article because I was like, yep, there it is. Like, of course,
it's golf. Yeah.
Like, if it were square dancing, we'd be like, okay, unusual hobby, but like,
yeah,
not traditionally a place where like men exclusively gather to do business deals and drink martinis. Not that these guys were drinking martinis to my knowledge, but like, it symbolizes something that is annoying.
And it's not just work that happens there. It's this, it's an informal friendship that is kind of intangible, but it ends up, you know, it ends up being part of the workplace, and it ends up, you know, being reasons why one person might be believed over another, because you know this guy and he's a good guy and he didn't mean anything by it. He's just awkward sometimes, you know, and that's, it sort of creates those bonds that then exclude women, not only from the workplace, but also from just a sense of familiarity, of being like a real person with real feelings. And that can be really dangerous, particularly when you end up with instances like this.
Yeah. And part of the point that you're making, Roxy, is that like what happens on the golf course doesn't stay on the golf course. Right.
There you go.
Like on the HR point, it, my understanding is that Richard Shields did, he did take notes, but the notes were never, they never resulted in formal disciplinary action. So I would actually love to see a follow-up report from CT on like the relationship between HR and executive leadership and why there wasn't any formal disciplinary action. But I have to think that some of it was a kind of familiarity that, okay, I heard this rumor about this guy, or I saw something a little bit weird, but like, I know him. He's a good guy. He means well. Yeah, he's a little bumbling, but like, at the end of the day, that person gets the benefit of the doubt, and the person coming forward to HR, you know, they're made to feel like they're oversensitive or just misinterpreted something or imagined something that wasn't there.
You know, that's a good transition to my second question about CT specifically. And this is something that you guys didn't talk about at all in your episode. So there's Mark Galley, who's sort of, I don't know, maybe 60-70% of the articles about him. He was there longer. He was the editor-in-chief, at least towards the end. He was your boss, right, Caitlin? But then there's the other guy, Talks. I will butcher Tokes. His Tokes. Tokes.
Oloye.
Okay, so I would butcher, I tried pronouncing it 2 weeks ago and it didn't go very well. This guy actually ended up being convicted of a sex crime.
Yeah.
Like in you know, court. And so, you know, with Mark Galley, there are consequences, of course, to like maybe some notes were taken, but there's nothing like official in his record. There's no disciplinary action. And okay, what did we miss? Someone could look at that and it could seem plausible to them to think of it like, well, okay, this guy might just be this kind of awkward boomer or whatever. And so missing it, okay, not ideal. Okay, with Tokes, no. It was missed and like there was a there to the extent that he was convicted or he pled guilty to soliciting sex from a minor. So that's just in my mind, like the connection between what are these mechanisms we have or that we are or aren't using and what they might tell us about the character of people in an organization and then what the consequence, like how much more enabled did he feel to pursue sex with a minor? I can't say, you know, you can't know for sure, but like, that's fucking crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I can't blame CT's policies.
Of course not.
For Tokes seeking to have sex with a minor. I will say that I didn't work directly with Tokes, but I definitely knew who he was and would see him kind of ambling around the hallways seeking to. He was known by the young women who worked at CT as someone that you kind of wanted to avoid being alone with.
Yeah.
And so at the very least, what ended up happening, a lot of women who worked at CT knew that HR or other leaders probably weren't going to do anything about Tokes' behavior. So they formed this like informal, like whisper network, like, hey, it got to the point where women would come into each other's offices if they saw Tokes going into her office because they were trying to protect each other. And on one hand, that's great that women had each other's backs. And it also just speaks to a completely inept formal response to behavior that was certainly boundary crossing, inappropriate, and definitely connected to other things going on with this person, right?
I think what is alarming about that too, that was hinted at in the article, is like some of those women that were forming this whisper network, like they were supervisors. They were in positions of authority and they had been victimized in this way too, and also did not feel like they had any power to intervene or to go to HR or to that their words, even as supervisors, as authority figures, would make any difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the women went to her one of the women interviewed for CT's article talks about going to her female supervisor and saying, you know, Tokes stares at my boobs in meetings, like, what should I do about this? Or can something be done? And her supervisor said something like, you could wear a scarf. And the person who, in later reflecting on this story on Twitter, which is a very important form of reflective discourse these days, this woman said, I actually don't blame my boss. Like, her response just indicated the level at which so many women, including women who theoretically could have had power to stop it, were disempowered.
Yeah.
Because there were these broader cultural norms that lent too much grace to men.
Yeah.
Yeah. Caitlin, you mentioned, you know, of course we can't blame CT's HR policies for Tokes' solicitation of sex from a minor, right? Like that's not a good way to think about responsibility. But a different way of thinking of it is like, if your organization happens to hire the kind of person who will eventually be convicted for soliciting mm-hmm. sex from a minor, mm-hmm. what kind, like, how would you want an organization to be able to deal with that person? Like, that's mm-hmm. more how I'm thinking of it, is like, mm-hmm. It's not about that it necessarily contributed to his actions, but he was always the kind of guy who was gonna do something like that. Of course, he mm-hmm. has agency, but people didn't know that. They obviously didn't hire him knowing that.
But there were patterns and there were signs, for
sure.
So
there's pattern recognition and sign recognition and having policies mm-hmm. for that. And then there's just, even if you're totally unaware of it, but like it's going to manifest itself in some behaviors, like how robust do you want your systems to be mm-hmm. able to catalog that, deal with it, fire that person if you need to, especially mm-hmm. at an organization that wants to be above reproach, air quotes, in any meaningful sense.
This is something that Roxy touched on in our own Saved by the City episode. I think this is where you get into different attitudes about Christian organizations and how Christian organizations should conduct themselves, and notions of forgiveness or reconciliation or giving each other grace.
Yeah.
Obviously, very core Christian concepts, and yet you can so easily see how they can be applied in situations that actually require justice for yeah. people who are marginalized, which the Bible also has a lot to say about. The Bible also has a lot to say about people who are warned about bad behavior and they keep persisting in the bad behavior and then they reap the consequences. I'm pretty sure that's what the whole book of Proverbs is about. Mm-hmm. So, like, if we're going to try to be a biblically informed Christian yeah. organization, let's make sure that we're reading the whole Bible. I feel fire coming off of my
She's going.
Mic.
She's at it.
We can hear it. Yeah.
Yeah. If you could add some kind of effect that really captures that, that would be good.
Josh, please throw. Yeah, please add in a sound effect that shows just how on fire. Maybe the NBA Jam. She's on fire. Although I don't know. That might only be there's only male NBA players. We're not going to get. Man, we're coming up against another hard limit here. The NBA Jam sound effects can't even be used.
Even sound effects are gendered. That's
okay, Roxy, what were you going to say?
I don't remember, but I do have to go soon, and I am about to pivot to talking in another interview about Hillsong. So
perfect.
We should just talk about that for a few minutes.
Yes,
which I cannot imagine two more polar opposite aesthetic cultures than Hillsong and Christianity Today, at least on the surface, which I think is just, there's probably a whole lot that can be said about how, like, this old boys club is not always old. Like, it's even yeah. existing in these new spaces. And, yeah. and probably in some ways because, like, they're just, like, there's core issues that go well beyond, like, the sort of surface aspects of a culture that you've set up. And so I think when we look at Hillsong and some of what has been reported on Hillsong, you see some very similar patterns that, you know, that were present in the CT situation, as well as like so many of the other Me Too situations that have been brought to the surface, which is like a complete lack of accountability, a lot of informality around reporting structures, as well as around employee relationships, which often happens in Christian organizations and churches because there's this sense that like, we're brothers and sisters in Christ. We're all in this mission together. There's a bigger purpose than both of us. And so there ends up being like, we're family, you know? And so there ends up being that environment, which I think creates all kinds of dangerous opportunities for predatory behavior.
Well, it basically excuses the lack of boundaries.
Do you think there's, I think that there's some self-selection stuff going on, like maybe not at the sort of Brian Houston executive level of Hillsong or Mars Hill or something like that, but most everyone else has like not gone into corporate America, right? They have, they have pursued a career path that is more informal, that is more local, that in their mind is like a calling from God to some degree. And that I wonder if there is something that is maybe a little less pernicious, that's more of a personality thing that is playing into this of like, we don't need the kind of structures they have at IBM. You know, like we didn't take that route, which doesn't mean that that's correct, right? But I wonder if some of it comes from that. And there's definitely a boomer type of that that I'm so familiar with. I'm sure you guys are familiar with too, that kind of casualness, that informality. I don't know. What do you think about that?
We're not going to be like the uptight madman generation. We can all just be friends and colleagues. And yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I do think there is some self-selection in that. But I also, whether it's self-selection or whether it's just earnestly believing the cause and the mission, and then you have this larger than life figure who oftentimes you like walk into it, into the situation already loving and believing this person, idolizing this person even, you know, and I'm thinking especially in the sense of like Carl Lentz or Brian Houston, but even, you know, even on a lesser level, someone like Mark Galli or just, or even Mark Galli as representation of Christianity today, which I know when I first walked in, I was like stars in my eyes. I'm working at the flagship evangelical magazine, you know? So any man that was representing that, I like immediately respected, you know?
There's also, of course, the danger of perceiving that someone is uniquely or directly called by God to lead in a specific position and that person believing it as well about themselves.
Yeah. There you
and
go.
That then, and that then serving to justify or excuse all sorts of inappropriate or predatory behavior because you believe that someone isn't just gifted, but like put there for a big kingdom purpose that you're willing to kind of look the other way when they slip up or extend them too much grace because what would we do without this person being at the helm? Like, is our church going to survive without Carl Lentz and his deeply V-necked shirts?
Right.
You know, gesticulating on stage every week.
TBD, whether they will survive.
Yeah, TBD. Well,
yeah, and then there's obviously, I mean, if you, Mars Hill, Hillsong, Willow Creek, all of these huge churches are now struggling in a big way. Well, Mars Hill doesn't even exist. Hillsong and Willow Creek are seriously struggling after the fall of their most famous leader. So there's something about the way these church cultures are built up around a charismatic figure that they like don't know how to go on even after that person has obviously like failed at a basic pastoral level.
Roxy, I know you got to go. Thank you so much for joining us for the time you could. Go kick ass on NPR.
Yeah, good luck.
Sounds good. I think it'll probably just be like a 15-minute interview. So if you guys are still on, I can always jump back on.
You're welcome to join back in. We got another half hour or so here. So please feel free to join us.
I'll talk to you soon. Okay.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.
If you'd like to support this show financially, you can become a patron at patreon.com/DanCoke. Patrons get access to the Facebook group, which is patron only, as well as at least 2 exclusive episodes per month. Right now, we are in the middle of a couple kind of ongoing series, gospel episodes with Ariel from Transregret Snoopy Presents the Bible, former guest on this show. She and I are going through one gospel at a time, and we just put out our episode about the Gospel of Mark, and we had Ash Nerve, co-host of the Boys Bible Study podcast, and also Ariel's editor, join us for the Book of Mark, and we still have Luke and John to come. And also, Tony Jones and I have been doing these Generation Gap Culture Hour kind of variety episodes, responding to more current events and current topics. Those have been really fun to make. So if you want to hear any of those, including any past episode from the Patreon feed, which includes all of our response episodes to The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill, you can become a patron and listen to any of those. Patreon.com/DanCoke, $5 a month. All right, back to my conversation with Caitlin. Okay, so Caitlin, I have a kind of a big question that I don't know how to answer, and I just want your take on it. So, you know, I've been researching spiritual abuse, which is not the same thing as these scandals. I would say all three scandals have resulted in spiritual abuse of many forms for many individuals, but it's not like, oh, how would we understand how these organizations fail? The best lens is spiritual abuse. Like, that doesn't seem right, but there's so much overlap that I'm kind of wondering what that relationship might be. Like, for instance, 2 of the main subscales of my spiritual abuse scale are maintaining the system. And that can be from both leadership and parishioners, employees, right? The woman's supervisor maintaining the system by recommending a scarf. And then the other big one is controlling leadership. And this is where, you know, this person, a direct line to God. So literally one of the items is my pastor or church or group leader explicitly claiming to speak on God's behalf. And Mark Driscoll always talking about God said it to me clear as day, plant churches, teach the Bible, you know, whatever. But that's that part. God told me clear as day, that explicit link. So there's some link between unhealthy organizations, and then, of course, spiritual abuse. And there's some way that they can inform each other, but it's really just kind of an open prompt in my mind that's coming up as we talk. And I'm just curious if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, reflecting on my experience at Christianity Today, I don't think I would categorize anything I witnessed or experienced as spiritual abuse. I would say perhaps one link is a misuse of power by individuals, and you don't have individuals misusing their power without a broader cultural context that enables and allows them to do that. So we have to understand all forms of abuse, whether, you know, sexual, financial, psychological, emotional, or spiritual, and oftentimes it's more than one, as not just about what happens between two individuals, but about a larger cultural context that allows abuse to flourish. And from what I experienced at CT, I do think that there's something in a lot of Christian organizations and churches that wants to not make waves, which is kind of maintaining the system. Someone going to HR is perceived as punitive or complaining or making too big of a deal out of something that's minor. Can't you forgive and move on? So you can see ways in which spiritual frameworks can go toward maintaining a system. I just remember a mentor in college telling me we should always assume the best about people and their motives. And even at the time, I was like, why?
Yeah. Are you going to get rid of the wise as serpents part and just keep innocent as doves, you know?
I at the time, I was like, I couldn't figure out, even from a Christian perspective, like, right. Wait, why do we do that? Because we also believe that people are capable of really terrible things. And so it seems like we need wisdom and discernment in interacting with other people, especially people in positions of power. But I think at CT, the benefit of the doubt, like assuming the best about someone's motives, was applied even in situations where it was clear as day that the person was overstepping boundaries.
Yeah. Yeah. I love you saying that, like, you don't get this kind of misuse of power, especially in an organizational setting, without an organizational culture and possibly a broader sort of national culture or subculture, like an evangelical subculture. You don't get the misuse without, at least you don't get it lasting long enough unless there is a culture that allows it, right? In a healthier culture, someone will misuse power and there will be consequences immediately, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's how you stop it. And if it's not been stopped for decades, years, whatever, then there is some culture that's allowing it. And I wonder if that might be the center of the Venn diagram between like what the spiritual abuse research is revealing and other domains of study, right? Like, because you're saying like for instance, the Christianity Today one is probably the one where there are the least instances of what I would consider spiritual abuse, someone's capacity for their faith truly being harmed through some sort of coercion and control. I'm sure there are individuals,
right?
But Hillsong and Bruxy, it's like when these pastors fall, that ends up harming the faith capacity of most people in those churches, or, you know, many, many, many people. And then all the people, all the staffers that worked under them and all this stuff. So maybe that's the overlap, is like, it's a helpful lens for looking at these cultures, these specific organizational, denominational, subcultures, whatever.
And I think it's worth noting that, to my understanding, the first instance of formal discipline against the former editor-in-chief took place because of a new president coming in from outside, and him just having a what I perceive to be like a no-tolerance policy. Like, this is formalized, this is serious, this is not allowed. Like, that was definitely tied to this editor's early retirement. And I wonder if sometimes it just takes someone coming from outside the system to see something clearly, because even while I knew this report was coming, I was the recipient of unwanted touch. I knew from several women at CT that they had experienced this too. And I definitely put that in the category of victimization. I also felt a measure of, I felt distantly implicated, because I had been at CT for so long. Like, I had been there in a position, you know, I'd been there for almost 10 years, and a lot of that time was in a position of leadership where the things that I did or not do or said or not say that signaled to other people this was okay. And that's why I think these instances of harassment or abuse, they just color your whole experience of an organization. You know, it colors now how I think about my time at CT in a really painful way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate you being so forthright about that. Yeah. Like to what extent did you recommend the scarf, you know, or what are some version of that, right?
Yes.
Having more power than some more junior staffers.
Right.
And, you know, like, I'm not implicating you, and I don't want you to feel guilt about that. But it is, your point is really good. I mean, literally, you are helping me with my spiritual abuse research live on the air. So thank you. I am taking notes that will make it into other stuff of mine. I'll try and quote you. But that idea that it often takes someone coming in who doesn't have the same cultural goggles on.
Yes.
And they can go, well, what the hell is going on here? This is not going to continue. And whereas you're in the you are the young frog. And how old were you when you started at CT? You must have been in your 20s.
I was a 23-year-old frog coming
23.
In.
So you drop in there at 23 and mm-hmm. you're there for 9.5 years as mm-hmm. the, and you're, you know, if you were my client, for instance, I would not blame you at 23 for not being able to figure that out.
Yeah.
Lord knows what I was doing at 23.
Yeah, you don't need to share that. yeah, no, I, you know, even though I'm saying, yes, there's a measure in which I want to interrogate my own complicity. Yeah. I also look back on my younger self and realize, how could I have known any better? Because I literally had no other workplace experience
right.
to inform what was normal or not normal. I came in and it's a Christian organization and everybody's like spiritual and upstanding. And so, of course, over time, I'm going to assume the way that things are done here are the way things ought to be done, or just the way things are in the world. You know, it's not until getting out of a system that you look back and can realize actually some of the things that we did, some of our practices and norms were really weird and unhealthy and need to be changed, you know?
You know, it kind of reminds me of Hillsong because they have their own like leadership school and Bible college. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that organizations that do have toxic cultures mm-hmm. are really incentivized to mm-hmm. hire from a young talent pool that is already invested in the mission of their organization. Mm-hmm. That like it would be disincentivizing, for instance, for Hillsong mm-hmm. as they're growing in the mid-2000s to be like, let's get this VP from eBay to come in and like, because the VP from right. eBay would know what normal corporate culture was like.
Right.
And
right.
would probably not be into the Brian Houston show, you know, mm-hmm. or whatever was going on at the time mm-hmm. that was, you know, serving his purposes.
That's really interesting. I've never thought about like these insular toxic cultures, and they can happen outside the Christian world as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
But something that's very like you're in or you're out, it's black and white. We do things a really specific way here, and the people who are on board need to do the things the way that we say they should. They are incentivized to hire people on where they can have like a strong power differential, you know, and young people whose passion and sincerity are almost being capitalized on. And I know that's a very cynical way to read it, but I don't think it's coincidental that a lot of these churches and Christian organizations that we're talking about, there's like the people at the top and then all the people at the bottom who are coming in, and not a lot of people in the middle to kind of hold the top accountable and then also empower the new people, you know?
Yeah. I mean, Jaffrey and I have been watching The Dropout on Hulu, which is the Theranos Elizabeth Holmes story.
Same-sies. Yeah.
And like what they did, and that's a very well reported, you know, they're mm-hmm. I know that the show is probably taking a handful of little dramatic, you know, they got to make good television, but it's been a very extensively reported case.
Right.
And they position Elizabeth as this mm-hmm. like female CEO, world saver, entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. So they mm-hmm. get all these people who look up to her. So they mm-hmm. buy into the mission. They get them to sign more NDAs more often than other people. Cause well, we do it this way and we have this secrecy and we have, mm-hmm. you know, it's all part of the mission. And they yeah. basically, you know, they're bad. She and her, you know, partner are bad actors, and they are able to use those mechanisms to hide their activity for mm-hmm. a stunning amount of time mm-hmm. And waste a stunning amount of money mm-hmm. of otherwise quite capable venture capitalists, you know, so that those kinds of cultural mm-hmm. dynamics, they fucking work mm-hmm. in a church or not in a church. Mm-hmm. They are effective. Mm-hmm. Eventually it catches mm-hmm. up to you, but mm-hmm. you can get a lot of damage done in the meanwhile.
Mm-hmm. Plus her deep voice. I mean, who could resist that?
Who could resist it? They do a really good job of treating that in the show. I want to ask you, I want to just pivot to, again, I know, funny joke about speaking for half of humanity, and you don't have to, but what might I be missing as a man as I think about these these multiple scandals, Bruxy, Hillsong, CT. What do you think jumps out to you as a woman that would not maybe jump out to me in terms of what they share in common or anything like that?
So a couple things. Because women are sexualized in mainstream culture, I think men have to understand, and I'm thinking specifically about the story at CT and instances of unwanted touch, and perhaps the touch was intended to be encouraging or familial, or then again, you don't touch people on the butt in your family.
Yeah.
Or you should not be.
Yeah, that excuse only covers some of the incidents. Yes. And not all of them. So that makes it kind of a suspect explanation.
Exactly. Exactly. So when my former boss at CT passed by me in the hallway, and it was just the two of us in the hallway, and he passed behind me and touched my lower back, I struggled to know how to interpret it. But of course, I had to wonder, is he suggesting something sexual? And so just examining the difference between intent and impact, and understanding that because a lot of women have been sexualized and demeaned and the recipients of very overt harassment, that should lead men, whether in positions of power or not, to reflect on the impact of their intentions and to get over their own, to examine the impact of their actions and to get over their own, yeah, but I didn't mean anything by it. You know, I think in the case of CT, I'm just kind of dumbfounded that so much of the defense has been, I didn't mean for it to be sexual. So therefore it was okay. It's like, can you really not get out of your own experience and take others' experiences as seriously as your own? Mm-hmm. So just examining intent versus impact. I think if you are a person of integrity, you're a man in some position of power or leadership in an organization or church, you want to treat women you work with dignity and respect. You don't want to be like these. You don't want to be part of the old boys network. It's probably going to require some discomfort for you. Like, when you get invited to the golf course or when you're in the room with just other men and you're talking or you're joking or you're at happy hour or whatever, you may actually have to go against the grain of conversation. You may have to call somebody out. You may have to appear oversensitive, quote unquote, or like, yeah, you can't take a joke, man.
Yeah.
Like, I really think that in a male dominant organization, more responsibility falls to men who want to do the right thing to speak up and to kind of risk losing a segment of power if it means empowering other people who you work with. And that's uncomfortable, you know, and you get why a lot of men don't do it. Right. Right, Dan? Oh.
I mean, I always do it. No, I do. And you know, I really like the impact versus intent distinction. And you know, it made me think about systemic racism. And I wonder if there's something particularly applicable about the intent impact differential in power differential situations. If maybe that's a common thread. Like, what I was thinking about was like just the, you know, just the suburban family doing extra booster events for their own kids' elementary school and, you know, none for the poorer elementary school on the other side of the city. No intent there to keep the black kids poor, but the impact of that is differential test scores, differential, you know, chances at a good life. And there's also a power differential there between those two neighborhoods and the amount of social and economic capital that those families have. And so I'm wondering, that's just something that came up for me is like, oh, that might be kind of a relationship. And then men, of course, have more power in more situations than women do. So that would be connecting it to that discomfort then. So I should expect to have discomfort more often if I have more power.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, so like my boss, when he eventually, whether he just connected the dots or the HR director told him directly that I had gone to HR after he touched me on my lower back, he came to me directly and said, if this happens again, just come talk to me directly. And you're rolling your eyes, and I wish that you're listening.
I hate that. I hate that story.
Why? Why?
I hate that he did that. It's such bullshit. It's fucking Mafia Don behavior. It is. Or it's like someone who's like, don't tell my parole officer. It's that kind of behavior, right?
Does it feel like such an obvious evasion of accountability? Like,
yes.
And threatening me in kind of a nice but clear way. Don't go to HR again.
It's, to be honest, it's very hard. I think it's hard to put myself entirely in his shoes, just because I can't imagine all the things that appear to be true about him being true about me. You know what I'm saying? Like I don't have a history of touching women that I work with. And I don't, you know what I mean? Like, I know what it's like to be a male I know what it's like to live in a society where women are sexualized and to think about women in a sexualized way. And I don't know exactly how much of that is my culture and how much of it is just biology or put it on a, you know, a bell curve, wherever I happen to fall on that bell curve. So I don't know what that part is like. I do know what it's like to have offended a lot of people in my life, but not around sexuality, more around being a big personality, egocentric, being impatient with topics I don't like. That's why I started a podcast where I get to choose who I talk to about what. I'm more comfortable than having to talk about what other people talk about. So that part's hard. But if I were, I hope and I think that if I were in a situation where there was an understood, established way to deal with things like an HR department, that to then go, let me see if I can just sort of hop around that and use my authority to sort of nip that in the bud. That part of the story is what sets me off and gets me rolling my eyes and then speaking with quite a bit of anger. That's the part that I hate about it.
Yeah, I definitely think that that comment was worse than the actual touch.
Interesting.
Because I can, even to this day, the touch made me uncomfortable, but I can imagine a world in which it was meant to be encouraging.
Exactly.
But I cannot imagine a world in which, you know, my boss says the next time this happens or if this happens again, just come to me directly, meaning don't go to HR. How am I to read that except you are trying to step around accountability and my ability to speak up about my own experience? We can't just handle this like brother to brother, because like you're my boss and you're 30 years older than me and you are in a position of leadership and I've been here for 2 years. And if you are that unaware of your own power, that is negligence to a sinful degree.
100%. These type of stories are when I am most convinced by the line of reasoning that is, you know, sort of the sort of privilege focused line of reasoning, right? The argument that what is really going on at core for a lot of these people in power who are often white men, but not always, is that their privilege blinds them to the fact that they have to play by the same rules as everyone else. Because that's another way of phrasing this, is that he came to try and make sure he doesn't have to play by those rules.
Yes.
But he knows, but he is the editor of a big organization. He's, you know, not the president, but he's number two, number three, whatever, at a big organization with like 100 or whatever employees. And I doubt he thinks that the HR department should be abolished. It's not that no one else should have to, well, maybe he does, but he wouldn't object. He wouldn't go to everyone's office and tell them all to come to each of them. You know what I mean? Like,
so he wouldn't apply his own rule in this situation to everybody in every instance where we might reasonably say HR should be involved. It just, he understands his own. He wants to evade the accountability that everybody else does. And he knows that he can because he's been allowed to, you know. And like I said, that comment was actually worse than the touch.
Yeah, I can see that. I have one more question for you to, because we have to be done here in 5 minutes as we compromise between our New York City and wooded Seattle suburb styles. How might these organizations be different if there were women either at the very top or at least many more women at multiple levels of authority in these organizations? What do you think?
So I'm not of the mind that just having more women in leadership in and of itself is going to solve these problems.
Okay.
Because, I mean, I think it is worth having regardless. Like, I think it is worth having more women in positions of leadership because women are full image bearers who have half of the world's talents and gifts and perspectives to share and lead organizations that where everybody flourishes. But I have also seen the ways in which women can be conscripted into patriarchal, male-centric organizations and can actually be almost like tokenized. Like, well, look, we're kind of egalitarian because we have a couple women on our board, or we just hired our first ever female managing editor. So we've taken care of the gender problem. You know, I think it actually needs to come down more to, or I should say, in addition to having more women in leadership, very proactive policies around sexual harassment, the difference between intent and impact, real effects and costs for people who go outside the lines. I think it's so much about holding people in positions of power and to account as much as it is about having more women in the room.
I think that's a great answer. I feel like I have time for one more question, and this one came from one of the listeners. So I want to see, I think you might have some thoughts. Is there a lack of sort of good theological and practical work around sexuality that has not trickled down into these spaces? Would more robust theological, ethical, you know, whatever, you know, organizational work around human sexuality make a difference if that could get into these work environments? Or do you think that primarily what we're dealing with is sort of top-down type of control where those people aren't, they're not going to read that stuff. It's not going to make a difference. You know, what do you think about that sort of dynamic?
Do we need a better or more robust theology of sexuality?
Yeah. I mean, especially for Christian organizations, right? Because obviously the theology is not going to affect the eBay corporate structure, but it might affect the Christianity Today corporate structure, you know?
I don't know. I don't want to talk about sex with my boss.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
but I certainly think that, you know, theological reflections on gender play a role in all of this. You know, like, again, my former boss has very specific essentialist ideas about men and women.
Yeah.
By the way, before my time, but I have since learned that there was a time when he was against flexible workplace policies for women who had just had babies because women shouldn't be working full time if they have children. Like, they should just exit the workforce because all women are nurturing and kind of designed to be at home with children. And you just so easily see how that attitude from someone at the top then creates a culture where women feel like, I guess I'm not finding support here to keep working because the editor in chief doesn't think that women should be working after they have children.
Yeah. Like, no. Big surprise that you. Yeah. And you didn't know that, of course, before you started. But it's
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Also, just his attitudes about men's sexual drives as being like God given or designed, and men are like this, women are like this, and as long as we all kind of can get behind that and stop buying into PC narratives about men and women, like, we'll all be better off. And
I'm so f-ing sick of culture war crap. But yes, sorry, it's hard. You're laughing at my facial expressions. I feel like I have to explain it in audio form to the listeners.
Yes. Oh, it's not. I mean, it is funny, and then it's not. It's really not funny.
No,
but like,
I know. Yeah.
So absolutely. I don't know if that needs to be brought out in a formal way in organizations, but certainly I do want to affirm that theology around sex and gender informs how people act in these situations because of what they believe about men and women. And then I think, unfortunately, can lead bad actors to excuse or justify their behavior by pointing to this notion that, like, God designed me this way or God designed men this way.
Yes. Future episode listeners to come about a concept called theologized trauma, which is basically about that certain theologies don't necessarily cause trauma, but they can provide scaffolding and cover for potential trauma. Mm-hmm. Really cool idea. Sam Young's my future guest. We're going to talk about that. So, but for now, Caitlin, thank you so much for coming. Tell Roxy, thank you as well.
She must be having a very good interview.
It must have gone very well.
It must be going very well. Yes.
So we should be happy for her. And again, we actually didn't cover all that much that you guys covered. So I would really recommend people, if they haven't yet, they listen to another 20, 25 minutes or whatever of you guys talking about this case on your own show. Link is in the show notes. Thanks so much, Caitlin.
Thanks, Dan. It was fun.
Amazon for last-minute gifts. Great deals for everyone on your list. Gifts for mom and gifts for dad. Even for your sister and your brother, Chad. Ah, shoot, we didn't realize we were supposed to get a gift for our dog walker guy. We almost forgot about our dentist, Dr. Kerr. We didn't expect to get a gift from her. Or our cousin, I forget his name. He got us something nice, better reciprocate. For last-minute deals on gifts for people you forgot, get fast and free shipping at Amazon.